Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu der heutigen Folge des Generate Neuroimmunologie Podcasts. We will switch to English now because we have a very special guest and we're so excited to have him. Frank, right?
Absolutely. No, I've been very much looking forward to today. And it's a great pleasure and honor to introduce Professor Joseph Dalmau, whom I had the extraordinary pleasure to work with for some time during my career. And I do not want to introduce him very much, just very quickly. He's probably one of the main figures in inventing the field we have dedicated this podcast to. Not the only one. We will be happy also to hear about some of the people he's been working with, but definitely one of the defining person. And it's very difficult to measure the impact he has had in the field of neuroimmunology in general. And he will be probably blushing, but I can say he probably has influenced this field for the generation to come, not on the past one. So thank you very much for willing to talk to us today, Joseph. It's a great pleasure. And why don't you let me start with a very quick question? I mean, maybe you can tell us and our audience a little bit, how did you get to where you are? This is something we always ask people, and it's probably a very difficult question to answer, but would be lovely to hear your personal voyage to where you are.
Well, thank you, Isabel and Fran, for inviting me to this Zoom podcast. Well, it's it depends on the age of the individual. So if you ask you how you reach there, you know, and you are very old, so and you are not so old, and you are very young, the answer will be shorter or longer, and also more in some way direct or indirect. In my case, it's a little bit indirect, the answer how, I reached this point now what I'm doing, right? So basically, it's a little bit of a long story. I mean, I was always interested in the complications of cancer and neurological complications of cancer, not precisely neuroimmunology. And my training was this one. After doing neurology, I was trained as a neuro-oncology, and it just only happens that I was interested in the paraneoplastic syndromes, but as a part of neuro-oncology. And it just happens that I basically went to New York City, to Sloan Kettering, to be trained as a neuro-oncologist. And when I arrived, Jerome Posner was at the stage. He had gone through many stages of discovery and describing in seminal papers different fields or different sections or areas of neuro-oncology. And at that time, he was working in the lab or had a group in the lab working on paraneoplastic syndromes. That it happened that had been in some way activated. The interest has been basically was activated a few years earlier by work of John Greenlee, who recently retired, a friend of mine. And John Greenlee and Frances Graus and Kurt Jekyll that were with him, and they were discovering antibodies in patients that had paraneoplastic syndromes. So when I arrived there, Cesc Graus, my dear friend and colleague here in Barcelona, he was not already there. He was already back in Barcelona. And when I arrived, I found that they have described the EGU antibodies and the YO antibodies. So part of my training was to have mainly clinical training. But I couldn't see patients because there was a new law in town that the foreign graduates could not see patients. And so I had to go to the lab. And Posner said, well, if you come here, you're going to have to go to the lab. So it was basically this torturous type of situation that I wanted to go there. I wanted to be trained clinically as a neuro-oncologist, but I could not see patients. Then I went to the lab. And after a few, in theory for 1 year, but then came another year. And after a couple of years, I was able to go and be trained as a clinical neuro-oncologist. And so this is basically how it went. This was the beginning. And then over the years, I spent 10 years instead of 10 years at the Sloan Kettering. Then I went to, for a short stay in in Little Rock in Arkansas, that it was a short but very intense and very important for me, the same as Sloan Kettering. And then when I went back to University of Pennsylvania, I continued with this type of work in neuro-oncology, seeing patients with brain tumors and any type of complications of cancer. And in the lab, continue with this work on paraneoplastic syndromes. But in Philadelphia, it was not longer a cancer center. It's a major center. It has cancer, obviously cancer center, but other areas of neurology, not only neuro-oncology. And we were called several times to see patients that had syndromes that in some way were similar to paraneoplastic manifestations of cancer, but the patients did not have cancer. You didn't even suspect to have cancer. They were very young individuals with no risk factors, but they had, for example, encephalitis, some of them limbic encephalitis, some not. And then this is when I applied my learning experience in the classical paraneoplastic syndromes to apply it here. And this was when, in some way, we started identifying some antibodies against cell surface antigens. And it happens that one of the first ones was the NMDA receptor antibodies.
Well, that's a very quick summary of an amazing story. And I mean, what's, I think, I know part of that story, obviously, for me, but this all has a very big influence, I think, in your research, right? This combination always of a very thorough clinical assessment as a basis for lab work. And I think this is definitely what I learned from you, but probably one of the key, can you say it? Is it one of the keys to the success you've had? So not only look at lab or only a clinic, but like have a very thorough clinical idea of the group of patients you're looking at, you want to analyze. Is that something you want to, would you agree or not, that this is one of the
key issues? Yes, in some way. In some way, the people that were trained with Posner, more or less, we have our type of background that is quite similar. So Posner is a great clinician. Now he's not practicing, but it was a great clinician in Barcelona, like, for example, in Germany, in France, in the UK. And neurology historically has been very strong, even much stronger historically than the U.S. neurology, but things at some point changed. And the type of practicing neurology that Posner has was very practical, was very, very guided to be fast in making the diagnosis and get the problem very fast and treat it. So you have to be a very good clinician, and this is what we learn from him, right? This is one thing. The other thing that I learned from him, it's just something very different from the way that we acted when we arrived. So you went to the lab and at that time I was very naive in the lab because I had no experience. So you have a hypothesis and you think the hypothesis, if this hypothesis is not demonstrated, okay, is a failure, right? So for Posner was just the opposite. In some way, if you demonstrate the hypothesis, it's great. But if you don't demonstrate the hypothesis, you find something else. For him, was actually even better because there was something unexpected and was a different direction. So this is what we also learn. So we keep an open mind. And one thing that you are sure for definitely is what you see when you examine the patient, or what you suspect, the differential diagnosis with you. But then when you arrive to the lab and you find unexpected results, becomes very exciting. And this is something that I learned from him, right? Which is something difficult because even in the people today that are in the lab, this is how they act, the same as I used to be at the beginning. So you give them some sort of ideas and they go, they try it and they realize that they are wrong, that they find something different. So that's exciting.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so that is the combination of clinics and laboratory. That's what I think is very interesting. I'm always very interested, and this is what my skills, if I have any skills, but these my skills are, is in the translational part, right?
And I think open-mindedness, right? Not only in society, but especially in science, is one of the biggest features I think scientists and clinician scientists need, right? Because sure, I mean, there's a lot of dogma around, and sometimes you have to have the ability to change a dogma. And this is a little bit, I think, what probably your name will be associated with, right? The NMDA receptor encephalitis, or anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. Although I do know, and you alluded to this a little bit, that there have been many, many groundbreaking studies work before that. But this is also an interesting story that you might have a few minutes to share. How did you find NMDA receptor encephalitis? This might be something a lot of people don't know and might be very interested.
Well, it was a confluence of several things, you know. This was basically after we arrived, when I say we, my wife and Dr. Miriam Rosenfeld and myself, at the University of Pennsylvania. And we, of course, we were the neuro-oncologists. And among the consultations, we had several patients that had encephalitis. And there were, in the first few months, there were like seven patients that had encephalitis. They did not have, initially, we didn't know that they had cancer. And so they call us, and this was... this was a little bit before the NMDA receptor encephalitis. And what we found is that among these patients, there were seven. Of course, there were other patients that had classical paraneoplastic syndromes, but I don't include them here. So of these seven patients, there were six that had an encephalitis, some of them with the flavor of limbic encephalitis with new clinical features and MRI findings. And some others not, some others more like diffuse encephalitis. And when we looked at antibodies in the patient's serum and the spinal fluid, we found only one that had antibodies against intracellular proteins. And this patient didn't do well, had a really paraneoplastic syndrome. The antibodies were against an unknown antigen, but it was intracellular. The patient had a thyroid cancer, and eventually this man died. And the other patients, basically there were, if I remember well, all were women except one that was a man. And eventually we figured out they had antibodies reacting against cell surface, neuronal cell surface proteins. And this took some time to find out, to set up the technique to identify antibodies against cell surface proteins. But this did quite well, these patients, with treatment. And some of them have a tumor, like there were a couple that had thymoma, and one of them had an ovarian teratoma, which it happens to be the youngest of all of them. It was a young woman. And it turned out that we published this in Brain, and we did not identify the target antigens there. We looked, but we thought that it was... the situation was interesting enough to publish these six patients, because what they had is that they have different types of clinical features, different. They didn't have the same syndrome. But what they have in common is that they had antibodies against cell surface proteins, probably different. But and compared with the classical paraneoplastic syndromes that we knew a lot at that time already, these did quite well. So this was published in Brain, and then it turned out that we picked up one of them. We could have picked up another one, because eventually, over the years, each one of them, each antibody of them, was studied separately, and each one had, it turned out that they have antibodies, one against NMDA receptor and encephalitis receptor, the other one against ZAMPA, the other one against LGI1, and the other one a mixed up of antibodies. So in some way, it was like a source of projects, right? Yeah. So the first that we picked up was a young woman that had the one that had an ovarian teratoma. Probably the reason that, to be honest, I don't remember exactly why we picked up this patient to study, but the main reason is that, well, this was one of the patients that we had in the hospital. Some of the other ones were referrals from other centers, but this patient was in the hospital. It was young. It was very typical compared with paraneoplastic syndromes. Had a very severe disease with prominent psychiatric symptoms from the beginning already. but with other neurological problems because she had to be in the ICU for several months. And then she reminded me three other patients that I had not seen, but people sent me information. And I was aware of these three other patients, and this one was the fourth one. And this was what formed the second paper that was published in Annals. And we published these four patients. In here, the angle was different. And in here, we published these four patients. Why? Because we still did not have the antigen identified, but all four were identical, different from the first paper. In the first paper, what they had in common is that they respond to treatment and had antibodies against cell surface antigens. In this one, the four patients are basically all four women with four ovarian teratoma, with prominent psychiatric symptoms, with the same type of reactivity over that brain, same antibodies. And 1 year later, then we published that with these four patients and some others, total 12, the target antigen was the NMDA receptor. So this is how everything started. But the information came from different angles at the same time. It was not, nothing is right, a straight line, right? It just came from information from different parts. So you have to be ready to get this information at some point and to digest it. And I was ready at that time. Perhaps other times in my life I've not been ready and I missed things, but at that time it was the right time to do it.
Well, isn't it like the good scientific career is always stems from preparedness and serendipity, right? You need both in a way, a little bit. And of course, preparedness definitely was a big part of it. Thanks you for sharing that story. So this has been more than 10 years ago. I know you're working on many other interesting scientific projects, but maybe you also have a little bit time to share with us this new exciting project that you are very heavily involved in, right? With the building dedicated to neuroimmunology and also like a more like a research center dedicated to this. So this would probably cement the Barcelona as one of the leading cities in this field, but it would be great if you could tell us about it because I found it very, very exciting.
Well, yes, you can find information a little bit in the web for the audience that want to see actually what's going to be the center. The center is going to be opening, partially opening, because there are going to be like five buildings at the end of this year, the latest in January. And this is, the name is Caixa Research Institute, and Caixa is the... The Caixa is a big bank, very influential and known all over the world, and is very interested and always been invested in research and social help, but particularly in in medical research and translational research. And this has a history of more than 100 years. So some important Spanish grants and Portuguese grants come from them, and they are very actually competitive and generous for pre-docs, post-docs, advanced and researchers that are very senior at different types of grants. So they came with a project, La Caixa Foundation, this foundation in the institute, they came with a project of developing then a center focused on immunology. In some way, focus also in different areas or different disciplines that are linked with immunology. So that includes, for example, cancer, because nowadays, particularly cancer, immunological type of treatments of cancer, CAR T cells, immune checkpoint inhibitors, and so on. There is a major advances in the field of oncology. So cancer is going to be, of course, neurology, neuroimmunology, is going to be infectious diseases, vaccines, etc. So, and also metabolics and all of these under the umbrella of immunology. So they have an area in Barcelona that, a little bit Barcelona, there is, Barcelona is between two rivers, the sea and a mountain at the background, a little hill or a mountain, yes. So they had an area there that belonged to the Cancer Research Institute that is in the city, and they are, it's 20,000 square meters, so it's a big area, and they are going to be, you know, it's going to be housing state-of-the-art facilities and immunology and different areas that I mentioned to you. And the idea is going to be around close to 700 people and 425 scientists and 45 research groups. And it turned out that my group and the group of Dr. Rabinovich, who is a cancer researcher, are going to, we are the first two groups, and also form part there of, you know, be integrated there without leaving where I am now. So I'm going to be bridging the two institutions with an agreement, right? So this is basically it. And now they are opening positions for investigators from all over. And it's becoming competitive, and people are all over. There are candidates from the US, from UK, from different parts of the world, and I was very impressed. I was lucky to be in one of meetings in that they present their work and their projects, and they want to why they want to come. And there were five investigators. And I was really very impressed. They are very young people. These are not very senior, and these are in the category of more independent investigators by juniors, and they were quite amazing. Yeah.
It will be very amazing to see what's coming out of this, and we'll be linking the link to your center or the future center in the show notes, then so people can check it out and maybe apply if they're still not with positions. So before I hand over to Isa for some other questions, also if you're interested in the history, the background, and also how the whole field evolved, Joseph and Seth Grouse have written this amazing book. It was published, I think, in 2022, right? In Cambridge University Press, I think it is. And it is called Autoimmune Encephalitis and Related Disorders of the Nervous System. We'll also link it out and you can check it out. It's a great book. If you're interested in the field, it pretty much summarizes a lot of the background. It's a great work. So Isa, you wanted also to ask a question, right? Did I see it correctly?
Sure. It's a question that I like to ask many scientists, but in this case, it's very interesting. I would be interested in what's for you the do's and don'ts in scientific research. Is there anything that you can or that you would like to tell to young researchers?
Well, as you have seen, I'm not probably a very good person to give direct, straight lines of what to do in your life, right? Because one thing was clear, I was interested in neuro-oncology and I followed the path, but then I follow a little bit what just interests me and I wanted to do. And I always been like that. So when I was at Sloan Kettering and I left Sloan Kettering, actually, I was basically getting the promotion finished that I was going to, they were going to give me a promotion. So, but there were several things that interest me more. Like I thought that I could follow more my interest at that time in another institution that people wonder, you know, the people said, well, why are you going there? Where are you going to, for example, Arkansas, if you are at the Sloan Kettering in the Mecca and things like that. So to answer your question is that people should do what they love to do. I mean, if they have a clear idea what they want to do and they go to a place and they feel that they are wrong, that being there, they fall in love with something else in science or in medicine. So then do that, right? I think that this, when you look in retrospect, it's you realize that each step that you have done that people didn't understand. And sometimes one is even confused why, well, I want to go there, but I'm not sure. And here is so great, you know, it's very in my comfort zone. I want to go there. So then you realize later on is that if you try to do a good job and you do it, when you look backwards, you say, oh my God, I should have done this earlier. I mean, it was not wrong. It was a good step. the same as to go to Philadelphia, and the same to go then to here to Barcelona, keeping a position in Philadelphia that I still have. But until recently, I went back and forth quite frequently. But since COVID-19, and probably get a little bit more tired of traveling, I'm going less. But so for young investigators, so do what you love. The second question, and sometimes this can surprise the people, but think that the institutions not necessarily love you. I mean, sometimes you feel that you are in this great institution, fantastic, so I don't want to move here forever in the world because I'm going to have everything that I want. It's not like this. It's not like this. Sometimes institutions, they have other interests and you are there. And this hasn't happened to me, but it turned out that almost every 10 years I change of institution, not purposely, except when I was in Arkansas. I changed of institution earlier because I had a great offer. We had a great offer, but nothing else. But so in a way, just follow it, whatever you want to do, if you can, and enjoy the ride, enjoy it, doing what you like to do. It's not like to go to a party, of course, and it's, everything is difficult, but at least to explore, okay, I want to go in that direction and in this institution that is considered of less ranking or more ranking than the other one allows me to do that. I think that this is probably an advice. This is probably the most important advice, follow your interest. And the second advice is that when I said that institutions don't love you, what I meant here is that more than follow the directions of an institution, the best thing to do is to find a good mentor. A good mentor. Mentors are very, very important, more than institutions. You just sometimes need a good mentor. And the mentor, it's going to direct you in many different ways. Posner is my mentor. I haven't spoken with him for a while now. But he has always been honest with me and telling, you are wrong, you are right. And sometimes without telling much of what you have to do, but just only a few hints, right, when you have a question. And so a good mentor is the best thing to have after loving some particular field of research.
Oh, that's a wonderful answer, to be honest, and I couldn't agree more on everything you said. It also, I think, can give some strength and hope to people who maybe they reach some barriers in life and feel like they will never achieve anything because there's this barrier. They have to find ways around, this love your topic and life will get you someplace. And the mentoring thing, obviously, is something I think that can't be overestimated in its role. And I have had the pleasure to have several important mentors, and one definitely has been you during my time there. So this is absolutely something that's really a strong influence in your life. So I think we have to finally or sometimes wrap up. There's one more question I think everybody would love to have your insight into, even though it's a very difficult question because there's obviously no clear answer. Can you try to look into the witch glass, have a look into the future of the field? What do you think? Where are we going? What will we be talking about in 5 years in this field? And I'm obviously talking about the field of autoimmune encephalitis or antibody-mediated disease in neurology. What's the big new thing in a couple of years? And feel free to answer it differently than I voiced the question now, but this would be something I would be interested in.
Well, sometimes when people ask me this question, well, of course, I don't have the answer, right? Who knows the future?
Who knows?
Is what Mark Twain said, that to make predictions is very difficult, particularly if these are about the future, right? So who knows? In terms of the specific question, sometimes I use the experience of the past of others and other diseases, like, okay, so let's imagine myasthenia gravis, or let's imagine Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, how this type of investigation has changed how has changed the direction of learning about these diseases that already very well we know a lot about them. So probably sometimes I do this exercise of many things that are going on. So how I see the future, well, probably in the future, you know, we are going to know many things about these diseases, and the wishes that I have in the future, in the most, in the few years in the future, is that probably people will become, will know better these diseases. And from the, just simply from the medical point of view, not mechanistically, of course, also this, but I wish that, and this is going to happen sooner or later, that people become more familiar with these diseases. That, first of all, seeing patients of are rare diseases, so that means to see patients and now and then one of them will come to you. But become familiar with them and learn from them and get this experience. And perhaps read more about these diseases that I think they are very good descriptions, particularly in the acute phase of the disease. So perhaps all of these will facilitate the diagnosis, not only relying in the antibodies, but also the antibodies or the discovery of antibodies would be, I think it has had a wave, and the big wave has passed. And now you're going to find that, yes, that there are antibodies that are described, but sometimes with the technology that we have nowadays and the sensitivity of the technology, the difficult part is not to identify the antibody, but then to identify the patients that have this antibody. So you may have five patients that have five different antibodies, but then, okay, but what are the other patients? What to describe the disease and say? So this will continue, but level down with the temper down the antibody discovery. And so I wish that also some areas of particularly of the main diseases, I think it's important to learn more about the cognitive dysfunction of many of these patients when they survive and overcome the acute phase of the disease, the cognitive problems that they have to get back to their lives, sometimes the psychiatric problems that they have. This is just quite interesting to many people, not only to neurologists. So this will probably also be described slowly in the next few years, but this seems to be something very simple that perhaps we already should know, and you know, but no, that's the question they have in the internet is related to these things. You know, do you think that a patient that is had symptoms for 3 months has still room for improvement? Yes, yes. Or the patient has been in the ICU for 5 months. So, and do you think that the patient is going to improve? Well, then depends on the disease. But yes, if it's some of these diseases, yes, don't discontinue the treatment. Don't give up. So there is a lot of confusion about this, particularly in the field of psychiatry, of epilepsy, still epilepsy much less now. And then in terms of the mechanisms, we're going to learn more about the mechanisms. But the important thing also here, I think, is important, is that in terms we already know that these diseases are mediated by antibodies or the B cells have a major role, let's say B cells more than antibodies. And of course, probably there's a component of inflammation, T cells, but this is a B cell disease, the same as we described the Lambert or myasthenia-like B cell diseases, right? So these mechanisms, we know more that the antibodies have effects. You can use in vitro models, in vivo passive transfer of antibodies, patients' IgG, serum, CSF, monoclonals. All of this has been demonstrated that they are pathogenic. And the immunobiology, I think, is very, very interesting. And I think that it's a very interesting, not only for this disease, but these diseases will help us to understand more the immunology in the CNS. So the immunobiology is something that I'm very interested now in animal models that we have about what happens with immune response. It gets amplified and it becomes polyclonal and becomes, there is a bit of a spreading, becomes more polyclonal. This is very, very interesting areas, topic. And then treatment, I think that what we are going to see probably in the next few years, not very far from now, that we are going to find that There are several treatments that already work for, we know that they work for the antibody-mediated diseases against the white matter, let's say MOLAT or aquaporin 4. There are some of these strategies that they will work with an NMDA receptor encephalitis and other encephalitis. If I have to guess, I would guess that, of course, many of them will work, okay? But we will have to put order in the field in terms of which one works better than other or faster than others. But this is something that we're going to learn with clinical trials. So this is how I see the most immediate future at this time.
Wow. This has been quite a very deep dive into the field. And thank you very much for the wrap up in the end. Ooh, not much to sum it up, right, Isa? So I think the main thing is to say thank you very much for this excellent insight and the whole big loop from your personal way to the field across the current project all the way to the future. It's been a great pleasure. I always enjoy very much talking to you and you know, I value your opinion on all these things very much. So thank you so much from my side.
Well, thank you, Isabel and Frank, for inviting me to this conversation. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Have a great day, Joseph. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Also, wieder zurück ins Deutsche. War das spannend. Spaß gemacht.
Sehr schön. Toll, ihn zu Gast zu haben. Finde ich klasse.
Er ist ja wirklich, dass er dieses lebenslange Commitment in diesem Bereich hat, mit auch einem unglaublichen Workload und trotzdem so ein sehr demütiges Auftreten. Das ist halt mal wieder faszinierend, ihn zuzuhören und wirklich diesen ganzen Loop zu hören. Man hätte jetzt genauso gut 3 Stunden mit ihm über klassische paraneoplastische Erkrankungen, WHO etc. reden können, wie eben über molekulare Analyse von Place Cells im Hippocampus. Und dieses Spektrum ist wirklich, wirklich beeindruckend.
Aber finde, ja.
Was hat dich am meisten beeindruckt? Was war dein Highlight?
Ich muss ganz ehrlich sagen, das liegt vielleicht auch ein bisschen dran, dass ich jetzt nur keine Ärztin bin, aber das Menschliche hat mich am meisten beeindruckt.
Und auch, ich meine, ich glaube, das kann sich jeder, der zuhört, der vielleicht in der Karrierestufe noch nicht so weit ist wie er oder vielleicht auch auf der Suche ist, sich hinter die Ohren schreiben, was er sagte. Also eigentlich ist es nicht schwierig, man darf sich nicht verunsichern lassen davon, wenn der Weg nicht geradlinig ist. Was sagt er? Love your topic, own your
Love
topic.
Love what you do and keep it what you do. Mind.
Und open-mindedness, ne? Genau. Also guck dir genau an, was du machst und irgendwie auch negative Ergebnisse können mehr als instruktiv sein. Und dann, das ist für mich ja auch als Neurologe auch im Herzen immer noch ganz wichtig, also kenne die Patienten, die du untersuchst, verstehe, was für eine Kohorte du hast, was die Patienten haben, such gemeinsame Nenner, suche gemeinsame klinische Features und gehe dann in die Grundlagenwissenschaft hinein. Also, wirklich schön. Mir hat es auch viel Spaß gemacht und freuen wir uns auf die nächste Folge, oder?
Das machen wir. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.
Tschüss, Ida. Tschüss an die Zuschauer.
Dir hat dieser Podcast gefallen? Dann klicke jetzt auf Abonnieren und empfehle ihn weiter. Bleib immer auf dem Laufenden und folge uns bei Twitter, Instagram und Facebook. Mehr Podcasts findest du auf meinpodcast.de.